I don't think it's helpful at all to talk about coaching or sport coaching. It's just, it's an umbrella term that's got so many sub-concepts in it, that to find agreement in there, to try to model it, to try to understand practice, to try to, I just don't think that it can be done. I think we've spent so much time trying to define it, and I don't know that we've wasted our time, but I think it's always been more complex.
Welcome back to Series 3, Episode 2 of the Coaching Discourse podcast. Today's episode, we're going to look at conceptualising sport coaching with our guests, John Lyle, Jamie Taylor and Andy Burns. I'll not labour an introduction to this episode because I think the guests can give a flavour of what it is that we're going to talk about throughout. And what I'll do pretty much straight away is hand over to John to introduce himself to our listeners.
Thanks, Derek. My name is John Lyle. I'm a professor of sport coaching at Leeds Beckett University. These days, I think I would say closer to retirement than to beginning. So I now work on a part-time basis in the university. So I'm still supervising research degrees and doing a bit of reading and writing. And I still do a fair bit of consultancy work inside and outside the university. My research areas, well, I presume that's partly why I was asked to be on it, but one of my key research areas is to work in the area of conceptualising sport coaching. And I'll no doubt get a chance to say something about that later, but I think it's an area that we've largely ignored or we've made assumptions about quite often in our work. And so that, and a little bit about decision making, which I maybe actually mention later on. So yes, that's me.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. And I suppose I might feel like I'm closer to retirement than the start of it, but hopefully I've got a few years left in the tank yet. So I'm Jamie Taylor. I split my time between Grey Matters as a coach developer, Dublin City University, Edinburgh University, and I've got a small role as an academy coach at WASPs. That's rugby union. Why am I here and what's my research? My main research interests are in coaching and performance enhancement generally. I would like to think of myself as being reasonably broad, and my focus is generating pragmatic, practical research that coaches can go and use to enhance what they do.
Well, in talking about retirement, I've already had a retirement as such because I was an athlete and retired in 2016. So I've already had my retirement. These are my golden years, as they would say. So I am a coaching advisor for UK Sport, former judo athlete and still current coach, working with GB Judo to some extent. So coaching a little bit. And I'm guessing the reason that I'm on here is my area of research, and I'm nowhere near as established as John or Jamie. I'm midway through my PhD. I am researching the balance between sports science and coaching and how they work together. So I guess that's why I'm brought on. And I'm a practicing coach, interested in all things coaching, and advise coaches from a UK sport perspective.
So the first question for me, Anna, is what is conceptualizing, and why does it matter when conceptualizing sport coaching?
I did think about it since Derek had sent the three questions that we were likely to talk around. I think for me the key thing is that dealing with conceptualization invites you to think about what you mean by something. And more particularly, I suppose almost to be jargony or theoretical about it, it invites you to distinguish between things. So when you define something as a concept and you look at the character of that and you look at the elements that are within it, what it's doing when it describes it is telling you why that's different to something else. That you get the essence of something by bringing it down to a conceptual level. And to some extent, it makes it sound like you're looking under the surface of something, that you're looking under the the practice. You look under the practice to find what you mean by the terms that you're using or the assumptions that you're making about the terms that you're using. And I think to answer Anna directly, the reason it's important is because concepts differ one from another, they differentiate coaching from teaching, from training, from instructing, from, it doesn't matter what it is, but all of those other words, then those assumptions, when they're put together, have huge implications for education and development. They also have implications for research. The very research populations that we use will be influenced by how we conceive of what we mean by, for example, coaching. So who are the people that we're going to speak to? Well, you're already making an assumption there that you've defined coaching or had an assumption about coaching in a conceptual way, and that leads you to then go and investigate a certain number of questions and with a certain kind of population. So I think that the reason it's important is that it influences education and development. It's very strongly influences research and the lens that you choose to look through. And it also influences your model of practice. It tells you what you think you mean by something and why you don't mean something else. And that, in a sense, I was trying to think of it not being defensive about it, because it has a kind of touch of reductionism about it. It makes it sound like you're reducing things down, almost to the point at which it doesn't become meaningless, but it loses a certain context. But I'll argue on my next question that actually context might be a concept that you want to investigate. So I can bring that back in when I'm talking about coaching. That little bit of a query about whether or not that means you're reducing things down. But the bottom line is that you understand things better, that you attach meaning to the things that you're talking about by differentiating them from other things. And that's what it means by dealing with concepts. And I think, there are different kinds of concepts, and coaching lends itself to a particular kind of concept, which maybe I will have a chance to talk about on the second, when we get to the second question. I'm quite happy to elaborate on it, but I would do it on the second question anyway.
Yeah,
that's my opener.
Yeah, plenty to dissect there. So Andy, I hope you don't mind if I put you on the spot as a more from the practitioner point of view. Have you ever thought about what you understand sport coaching to be then? Or have you ever thought about what your concept of sport coaching might be as a practitioner?
Not to the same extent as John has, but certainly have. And I do believe that having a concept, when I was asked the question, I Googled, what does conceptualizing mean, as everyone does at the first point. And some of the language that came up was abstract or creation or a way to think rather than do, and the meaning around that, which actually got me thinking around how do we conceptualize coaching? How do we think about how we go about it as practitioners? And then from my role, how do we think about coaching, and what do we mean by that when we're working with coaches? And I come back to questions that would, in terms of where does the coaching happen? And therefore, what does that mean for how we think about it? And then as an example, as a practicing coach, I used to always think it just happened from the start of the session to the end of the session. That was when coaching happened. And I was challenged on that fairly heavily as an early practitioner, as what about when the athletes are WhatsApping you over the weekend about something that's happened and therefore they can't come to training and you're having those conversations? Is that still coaching? When you're texting them about what's happening, are you still having those interactions in a way that you would consider to be coaching? So I've been challenged a few times on what do we mean by that and how do we think about how we go about it. So yeah, I think when you open it, it can be really broad. And as John said, or you could reduce it really down and go, it is this and nothing else. So yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Derek's got his hand up. Do you want to jump in before I speak to Jamie or...?
It's probably just building on something Andy said. Is coaching something we do or someone we are?
Is that for Jamie to answer? Because he hasn't spoken yet.
Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? I think it's an interesting question. I think that'd be, to answer Derek's point of view, I would suggest that coaching is something we do rather than something that we are. If you're going to put a label on me, I'd certainly describe myself as a coach. It's one of the things that has really brought me one of the things that have brought me the most satisfaction in my life. So it's clearly going to be a key component of my identity, who I am. Going back to some of the points that were made earlier and the idea of conceptualizing different elements of what we do, I think that that's a really fundamental element of coaching practice. And I say that not just from a research point of view, but from a practical point of view. And you made the point about abstraction and how important abstraction is in understanding concepts and being able to think things through and be able to make sense of the worlds that we're in. I just released a paper talking about the importance of conceptual clarity and the importance of abstraction and how it enables transfer between transferability of ideas between different domains. And I think that we're in an interesting place as a profession. I'm sure John's ears will pick up when I say the interesting place as a profession, but perhaps we can come back to that. Where there isn't the level of conceptual clarity that I think that we need. I don't necessarily think that we all need to speak the same language, but I do think that we need to understand what we're saying and if individual terms should mean the same thing when we say them. And that lack of conceptual clarity, I think, is really holding us back. I also think a lack of emphasis on coaches having conceptual clarity for different terms holds them back from really advancing practice and making the most of what they do and really enhancing performance of athletes or enhancing participation aims as well.
Two things. Just to react to something, I think it was Andy that raised it. Actually, I think Jamie said something and it brought to mind when I was originally responding to Anna by saying education and development were important, research was important, being able to understand practice is important. So how you conceptualize things leads to all of those. The bit that I missed out was policy. And I didn't mean to miss it out, but that policy is really important. And there's a wonderful example just at the minute, which will either take me a couple of seconds or an hour and a half to talk about, which is if Sport England, well, actually, if the government decide that coaching is this, and Sport England have to buy into that because that's where their money comes, and they say this is what sport coaching is, and UK coaching get their money from Sport England, so they say this is what sports coaching is. So that concept of all embracing, if it moves, it's coaching, that has permeated through into policy. Now those are about concepts. This is sport. Well, it's probably I'm not quite sure where exactly it comes from, but it comes from the inclusion agenda, roughly speaking, plus health and obesity and other things, from government. But they are attaching a particular meaning to our concepts. When I say our concept, I just mean the ones we use all the time. And so it's concepts can be a contested arena. We don't all agree, as somebody just, Andy or Jamie just said, we don't necessarily all agree what we mean by these things. So I do think it's probably at the minute for me the best example of why concepts are important, because we now have a policy by the regulatory authorities, as we would call them, that's led by a particular concept of coaching. But that was actually just my first point. The second point, I think it was to, you know, when you said you think of coaching as, I think it was Andy, being just, no, you had originally had a view that coaching was when you turned up to when you left. I think a way of thinking about that is that coaching is a contract. Coaching is a contract between a coach and an athlete, or a coach and a team. Now that contract may, and I don't mean it's a written contract necessarily, it's an understanding sometimes rather than an actual contract. And it may only mean that you agree to turn up for an hour a week. And that they don't agree to do any work at any other time, and that you're really just, you know, coming for an episode together, and you agree that you'll help them to become better at sport. But that contract could also be with another athlete, which is a full-time contract. But that full-time contract doesn't need to be a full-time employment. It just means, to some extent, that you never stop thinking about it. So sometimes you'll be intervening, which is the practice. Other times you'll be speaking with them. That's the interpersonal stuff and the goal setting and all the other things that go on, the counselling and whatever, the career advice, that all the things that you might end up being engaged with. But the other thing is that you engage in a kind of contract that leads it to almost becoming part of you. It becomes part of your identity. Not just I am a coach, but I am a coach of Laurie. I am a coach of Anna. It becomes a contract that you have, and that takes over. You know, I don't say for the good or ill. I just mean it's more than just the intervention.
I agree completely. I think it is a contract, but I think my experience of working with athletes in the past is you're contracting all the time. It's an evolving process. Uh-huh. It's not, and that changes as the athlete develops and grows into whether they're going to be professional or move into world-class program, whatever that looks like. That contract changes and shifts with your relationship. So it's a process rather than a thing.
Uh-huh. And sorry, Laurie, and interesting. I've coached individual sports with individual athletes, but largely it's been team sport, for example, in volleyball. So in a sense, the contract has almost been the same for about 10 years. But it's been made up of lots of little contracts because the personnel has changed all the time. So sometimes those players have been the same age as me or more experienced than me in settled employment. They've got family things that we know about and share. And at other times, you've got a 16, an 18, a 20-year-old coming through, and you almost have a worryingly strong influence sometimes on how they see their future careers and, you know, even relationships and all sorts going on. So, I agree entirely. I think you can have almost like an umbrella contract, and then within that, you've got all these individuals that you contract with. Sorry, Laurie, go on.
Not at all, don't apologise. How I'm hearing that is that coaching is a supporting role, a relational role, and rather than the word contract, I would lean more towards the responsibility that comes with it. So it's a lack of concept. You said right at the beginning that you think it's been an area that's been somewhat ignored in recent years. So is a lack of concept in sport coaching a limiting factor in what is the far-reaching benefits of what sport coaching can be?
Well, I would struggle to answer that simply.
Go for it. I think Julian once spoke, and I loved it. I was on the edge of my chair. I think he once spoke for like solid 15 minutes once in response to one of our questions. So I think don't hold back, John. Go for it.
If I was to say that coaching in some ways was being held back, that would be because I was probably taking a different interpretation of some of the concepts we are talking about than others might. So if I used back to that policy example, I don't think we're being well served by coaching, by policy at the minute, but that's a particular perspective I'm taking because the parts of the social world that I think coaching inhabits, and that would bring me to the next bit where we say, well, what do you think coaching is about? But the bits that I think it's about, I would differentiate from sport leadership, from animation, from the French animateur, of simply engaging people in the learning of sport. That, for me, might fall into an umbrella term called sport coaching, but it very much is I would say it was a meaningless term. I don't think it's helpful at all to talk about coaching or sport coaching. It's an umbrella term that's got so many sub-concepts in it that to find agreement in there, to try to model it, to try to understand practice, to try to I just don't think that it can be done. I think we've spent so much time trying to define it, and that we've, I don't know that we've wasted our time, but I think it's always been more complex, and it has always had these subdomains within it that for good reasons in the past, to do sometime with empire building or policy building of the old NCF when it first started, we've tried to gather a population of coaches to build not quite professionalism, but at least a burgeoning profession of coaching. And we've not been very successful. And part of that, in my view, is that because we've not addressed these sub-concepts. But community coaching isn't the same as high-performance coaching. No matter how you divvy up the gate, it's not the same. So if you try to embrace it by just one word, sport coaching, or two words, I know, then that doesn't work. Unless you simply mean there's a great big umbrella area of sport leadership and we're going to call it sport coaching. Now, that might be helpful, and I don't deny it, but I'm not sure how really helpful it is once you get to building professionalism or occupationalization or, you know, back policy, education, development. You do need to come back down to some narrower concepts. That doesn't make one more important than another. It just means we know which ones we're talking about.
I need to be somewhat careful whilst on my brief hiatus from working with a national agency where I did have responsibility for how we construct frameworks through which we might educate coaches in various domains, be that operating within the community space or delivering against wider outcomes on the health agenda, or conducting social work through sport coaching. And I agree with John in terms of the level of conflation around what sport coaching is within the system is rather unhelpful. But equally, if I rather than trying to over intellectualize at the moment, and bringing back to a conversation Jamie and I had offline last week, I really want to nest perhaps conceptualizing sport coaching on an individual level within sport coaches themselves, and a number of people on this call, in fact probably everybody on this call, has operated as a coach developer or has developed coaches on an individual basis at some stage or continues to do so within their career. And what I find something that's ever present when working with coaches is, back to Andy's point, they only ever see coaching as the interaction between the coach and the athlete. Daydreaming about coaching is coaching. You know, something popping into your mind, taking a note of it, integrating it into a plan is coaching. Phone calls with athletes is coaching. Talking coaching with other coaches is coaching. Anything that informs and develops your knowledge base, which you may then go on to use in the context of practice, I believe is encapsulated in what it is to be a coach, which is probably where that question around do I do coaching is coaching who I am. I think back to the point around contracting, well, you can set boundaries in a contract between the coach and the athlete. There are no boundaries to the thoughts that might pop into my mind, the passing moments where I invest some time in thinking about what I'm going to do this week or this month or throughout pre-season. So I think even though those concepts themselves, even things like silence when a coach is observing, that is coaching. So, like, until we support people to have a broader conceptualization of what coaching is, will we continue to have this, norm within sport that coaching is simply what happens at the pedagogical interface between the coach and the athlete?
And look, I think just listening to Derek there, we've obviously had we've had this conversation offline a few times before. I actually think that for the majority of the time for coaches, this is almost a plain and simple, obvious idea that coaching isn't just what happens on the pitch, court, wherever. Because, and I say particularly so for coaches that are more invested in spending more time with a particular athlete. I think that what we're talking about here has particular implications for coaching research, more so than necessarily for coaching practice. And I say that having had a paper rejected from a coaching journal because it looked at input of multiple different stakeholders, and I was told, no, this isn't coaching. It's something else. And I'm thinking, okay, thanks very much for the feedback. I suppose what I'm stuck on here is that if we're conceptualizing coaching in the narrow sort of ways that often literature leads us to conceptualize it, or down the narrow epistemological tracks that reach the research takes it, we get further and further away from the needs of practice. And coaches, and look at coaches that I work with, both as a coach developer or as a coach, if I show them the front page of most coaching journals and I look at the articles and ask them, right, what, pick one here, what looks interesting to you, what might be really valuable, there are not going to be very many. And that, to me, is an enormous problem for our profession. Again, I'm using that term deliberately, sorry. And I think it's leading us to a stage where we're not progressing in terms of research-informed practice. There are pockets of interesting work, but not very much of it is actually for the coach. There's a hell of a lot that's of the coach.
Very briefly, I'll say, 100%. I've written, if anybody saw my presentation at the Gloucester conference a couple of years ago, I did my best to take coaching research to bits. I think it has so many weaknesses and limitations, not because it's bad research. It's often carried out very well, but whether it asks questions that coaches themselves would think were important is very different. If you start off by saying, where did this question come from? Why are you investigating this question? Is it because coaches are clamoring to have the answer in order to improve their practice? Well, generally speaking, no. Is it coming because that's an area that you're particularly interested in and you think you might get another publication out of? Then, yeah, probably. Much more likely to be that. I have done a couple, twice in the last 3 years, a brief survey, about 300 papers, and looked at the proportion of them that investigate practice. And it's handfuls at the most. It's actually quite difficult to find any once you start playing around with it. But I'm entirely with Jamie that we are not seeing coaching practice as something that should be It is quite difficult to investigate, because we're talking about in situ contextualized practice, about which it's difficult to make generalizations, and therefore sometimes researchers and sometimes journal editors are thinking, well, I'm not sure whether this case study or this particular case example is something that we need or we want to publish. But we are replete with interviews. You often interviews of about half a dozen people. And whilst there's nothing wrong with it as a research method, if it's the only one we're doing and we're getting reported practice rather than actual practice, then our research is falling short. We're not answering any of the pragmatic questions. I don't think it's wrong to say, why does this work? Does it seem to work? Why does it work? I think that's a reasonable question. It somehow is given this bad press that if you ask, what works then? It's almost like that's a bad question to ask. And I think, no, it's not, not at all. Why does this work in that context with these people? That's a very reasonable question for a researcher to be asking. Why does this particular practice work in this context, etc.? And we don't do anywhere near enough of that at all.
And I'm suddenly withdrawing the paper that I've got in for publication at the moment, which is a study of 6 coaches. John, thanks very much for that.
Well, I hope that wasn't me that read Jamie's.
John, based on what you said then, it just got me thinking around some of the early research around coaching practice, which was observation of coaching behaviours. I'm wondering if you felt like the research that was done maybe stung coaches. I remember reading some of it saying, oh, this much was instruction, this much was berating athletes, and whether or not that had an impact as to whether coaches engaged with research in that way. And my second question, I'm taking the role of the interviewer here, sorry. My second question would be, how have you seen the approach to research within coaching change over time? The good, the bad, and the ugly?
I always thought that systematic observation and just behavioural observation, which is what a lot of the early research was like, I always thought it got a bit of a bad press. I do accept that it was a particular ontological or epistemological approach, and that it had a lot of limitations depending on how you interpreted your findings. Was it a bad thing to search for some regularities in people's behaviour? Well, I didn't think that was a bad thing at all. The issue was not to jump from finding some regularities to saying, well, this is what you must do. Because the bit that was often missed was the context. So you had to then say, well, yes, we did a bit of research, but we did it in the context of high school coaches in America with a particular aim and ambition, which in all honesty was not always asked. So why were they doing what they were doing? What was the aim of the session? What were the goals? If you didn't ask those questions, then to find the regularities in behaviour, well, was interesting, but didn't take you quite as far as you would like to go. You needed to add context all the time. I have a phrase I use in publishing things that you can only understand coaching in its particularity. It has almost no meaning unless you particularise it to the particular context it's in. Once you've got the particularity sorted, you can understand better why they're doing what they're doing. What has changed? We've gone down the interviewing road. We're much more qualitative. It's much more qualitative stuff. All done well. I'm not saying we shouldn't do any of it. I just want more of the other stuff. I would like a bit more of the investigation of practice per se. So we've investigated too much asking coaches what they think about things, bringing in a theory from somewhere else. You know, I've got to be careful. Yeah. Just because I'm just having reviewed a paper, so I maybe should stop at that point. But if I generalised from it, it was bringing a theory from education and then looking to see whether coaches were, if you like, adhering to it, to its best practice, at the epitome of this theory in practice. And then saying, well, coaches aren't very good because they're not doing this. And you think, well, who said that was a good thing for coaches to do in the first place? Was it? You know, so with research has become far better. We're far better at it. I think we've moved a little bit towards some of the critical realism type things, which may be asking deeper questions about why things work and why they don't work and why they are as they are. But I still think we've not moved anywhere near practice as much as we ought to.
Thanks, John. And before Jamie comes in, anybody who was struggling with the words ontology and epistemology when John surfaced them at the start of this, we have an episode on ontology and epistemology in series one, episode two. Sorry, Jamie, and you come in.
That wasn't Julian, was it?
No, it was Andy Abraham.
All right.
Dave Piggott and Finney Webb.
Okay.
We do also have an episode with Julian. This is like a little short plug here, isn't it, Derek? I don't think we've ever done this before. This is what happens when you get to series three. You try and convince people to go back to the beginning.
No, look, I suppose, John, I was actually just going to push back a little bit on the idea of interviews and them being worn out. I think that it depends on the question that's being asked. And yes, there's a lot of very descriptive interviews, but I'm not convinced that we've gotten really to the heart of either coach cognition or indeed the output of all of this, which is how does the athlete experience what the coach does? And now that is something that I think is near, just has not been as very, very, there's very little that's been done there. And I suppose my thought would be that where the research is at is that there's not necessarily loads of research that's that has really gotten into those two factors. I would agree with you that, for example, in comparison to World of Education, where we can get stuck in some really big numbers and we can start doing comparisons of different pedagogical approaches. But even then, we're stuck with significant issues. So I suppose I would have less of an issue with the application of different educational ideas. So, for example, cognitive load theory is a really robust theory that's had very, very little impact in the coaching world, and yet would seem to be a pretty fundamental building block of learning. I suppose in summing up, what I think I'm getting at here is I don't think that coaching research is applying theories from other domains particularly well, or particularly for the needs of practitioners who are really interested in how do we help enhance our practice. So two ends really. One, I think that the kind of research you're talking about with understanding coach intentions, using a particular approach, and then looking at the results of in a particular context, really useful case studies, a few of which I hope are on the way. But I think there's still a lot of value to be gained from the other kind of research, so long as it's got decent epistemological foundations, I think.
I see Derek going to jump in. Just to react to that, Jamie, I'm really happy with interviewing in the sense that if you're asking someone how they have experienced something and you want to get into some real depth in that, some real examination of their in situ understanding of something, then absolutely, totally, you know, that more of it. Where I think I don't like it is where it's interviewing has almost become what you would call a mini survey. It's like we haven't got 40 people, we haven't got 180 people, but we can have 6 or 8. And it's almost treated like a mini survey rather than 8 cases or 6 cases, which there may well be some interesting cross comparisons between them, but not to be treated as a let's do some thematic analysis of all the responses. So it becomes a little survey, which I don't think stands up a lot of the time. I hope that's not your paper, Derek, when I say that.
Well, I think the interesting thing is Jamie mentioned two things that I've either been involved in the research in or intending to do some research of. And the athlete experience one is one that I'll probably speak more to in the fact that the value in that in terms of developing coaching practice is huge. And Laurie's a colleague of mine in a longitudinal study we've done on a particular sport where we followed a set of athletes over the course of 14 months to understand their interactions with and experiences of the performance pathway and the coaches and the practitioners within that. And the richness of the data across what was planned, what was delivered, what was experienced, and what was culturally absorbed as a consequence of those interactions and experiences can go a very, very long way towards us understanding how we can make changes to innovations in coach education, coach development, coaching practice. Because the knowledge that we're garnering is from the ground up. Now, we conducted that through an ethnographical research design where our field workers were embedded in situ, taking a mixed method of interview, as well as I said, observing the actions, interactions, and experiences of athletes. And that interview data that was gathered wasn't just with coaches, it was with athletes, practitioners, performance directors, pathway managers in British programs, to try and give as rounded a view as possible to inform what coach development, coach education might look like for that particular sport. So I would probably echo Jamie in terms of, you know, if that's a route or a blend of methods to take, then that probably provides us the, in my view and in my experience, a sound direction of travel to understand coaching practice.
I think if you're using the interviews to enrich that ethnographic picture, then 100%, yes. I'm reacting, I think, against those almost individual studies where we think, I'm quite interested in that, I'll go and ask six coaches over there what they think about it. And that's all they're doing. You're really doing. You're just going and asking those six coaches. It's not sitting inside a bigger study of the kind you're talking about. So where it's that kind of enrichment of evidence, of data, of insight, absolutely support that 100%.
I'm going to position a question for you, Andy, in a moment. I just want to share a couple of quick reflections. I really like the way that Jamie positioned the coach as almost an information broker. You know, if there's going to be lots of time and money spent doing research, well, ultimately it's going to be the coaches and the people that they work with that are going to be the brokers of that information and how they choose to use it or not. And so how do we generate knowledge with coaches and their interactions with their experiences? And there was something that John said around different sports and different domains, you know, participation, high performance. And I think about the diversity of sports that I get to work with. And if you were to ask and I'm not just going to use the word athletes, but the individuals experiencing those sports, how different it would be if you asked them to conceptualize what coaching is. It would be so different across sports. But my question to you, Andy, is based on a wee conversation I had with you wandering around Leeds. And I noticed that we've been talking about coaching as almost a singular, a person. And I think, based on what I know about you and your areas of interest, that would be plural. And I wonder if you could just speak to that for us, please.
Yeah, more than happy to come in on that one. But before I do, one of the things I've been considering, based on actually the first time I heard it was from John, was the difference between successful coaching and effective coaching, or put in a different way, elite coaching versus coaching elite. And I've seen that sort of play out, and actually the conceptualization of the different, I guess, levels, I hate to use the word levels, but the different places where coaching might happen and how you would define what effectiveness is, if that was done in an appropriate way, then coaches who coach 1 hour, 2 hours a week would have a good understanding of what it is that they're trying to do that would be effective. Likewise, so would the elite professional coaches. But I just thought I'd share that because it's something that has resonated with me in the work that I do. And like you, Laurie, I'm privileged to work with a number of coaches across quite a wide and diverse array of sports. So see what would be effective coaching at the different levels within the pathway. In regards to your plural question, so my area of research is around the sports science, sports medicine team, or the performance support team and their interaction with the coaching process. And I think as we've had the growth of different types of practitioners, even practitioners that pathway scientists, heads of performance support, physiologists, and Jamie shaking his head, that we've got more people with deeper, nuanced expertise, knowledge bases, skill sets, and behaviors that come into the athlete's experience. And therefore, do we consider the coach as the orchestrator of that? Or are they part of that team and someone else orchestrates it? And how does interactions play out? Now, depending on where you operate and what sport you're in, you might have a team of 8 practitioners that you have to manage with the athlete in terms of the inputs that the athlete gets. How do you ensure that that's coherent? How do you ensure that you're all clear on what it is you're trying to achieve and working together towards that, and which part of that you're working on? Does the physiologist only get excited when they hear about the numbers and the data coming in and don't have a conversation about, well, what's happening in terms of sort of the skill development point of view? As an example, I'm not hitting on physiologists, but there's lots of different dynamics that play out, particularly within the elite environments. And if you cascade that down to lower levels of the pathway, you might be talking about different stakeholders. It might be different coaching teams. It might be they have a gym instructor at a local gym. It might be actually there's parents who are part of that coaching process as well. So we move away from the singular coach to multiple people involved in that coaching process. And I still think we haven't really bottomed out who navigates that. And ultimately it comes down to the athlete. So therefore, what skills does the athlete have to be able to navigate the different inputs they have? And then we start to get into the area of Jamie's remit of research. So I will stop and pause.
No, look, Andy, I think you sum it up nicely in that you're getting a hold of understanding the totality of an athlete's experience. And look, I think obviously Andy's work is taking this beyond where some of my work did. But it was unsurprisingly that some of the work that I did showed that athletes who are progressing through a talent development system tend to accumulate more and more voices who are impacting them in a coaching capacity, whether that's a massive multitude of different coaches to parents to anybody else. So look, I think that is well worth bringing those ideas into the discussion here, because we are the coach. And I think I really like the idea that John offered earlier about the contract between athlete and coach. I think particularly in the high performance realm, we are entering a situation where it's a contract between athlete, coach, staff, funding body, club, all sorts going on.
Can I add a couple of concepts in, if that's the bit that we are talking about? We haven't actually had that question yet. Well, Anna changed the question after the first one, and it went on to, well, what do you think coaching is, rather than just what do you think a concept is? So we never got back around to well, what do we think coaching is? And just to raise, and I'm using that as a segue into responding to Jamie and Andy. Without making a very specific point, I've just jotted down three things. I'm not sure it is the athlete that brings it all together. I'm not convinced about that. I think there's a difference between team sports and individual sports. And I think there's a difference between engine sports and technical sports. So an engine sport is some aspects of athletics, some aspects of cycling, rowing, where in effect, yes, you need to have a very efficient technical capacity. And yes, there are decisions to be made during a race. There's the pacing, there's, you know, decisions about what you do and when you do it. But in essence, it's about how good your engine is. And I think there are an underexplored area there is the extent to which the coach is influential in an engine sport. And I would say, actually, I was in a meeting yesterday where people didn't want to call them the support team because they weren't the support team. And I'm okay with that. That actually there was but the role that that sports scientists and others were playing in that engine sport with individual athletes was much larger than in the sports where the coach became more accountable for the performance itself, because the coach ultimately was making decisions during the game and in selection and in tactical decision making and all sorts of things. And a phrase I used yesterday, I jotted it down, I'm going back a couple of pages here, that the whole team was sharing the responsibility, but the coach had the accountability. So who do you sack? You don't sack the whole team. You don't sack the support team. You sack the coach, because you get appointed on responsibility, you get sacked on accountability. And I don't make a particular point on any of that. I think it's a whole area that we haven't got to grips with. It's about roles. It's about individual roles and where the responsibilities lie for all of that.
John,
I think at elite levels can be really quite important for not just your mental well-being, but your whole career and your, you know, professional sport. Who's actually making the decisions? It's not the athlete. It might be the athlete's agent, but that's a different issue.
I was just going to jump in and suggest that the way that we've positioned it is that there's a bi-directional responsibility there. Athlete responsible for their career, their performance to an extent. Coach obviously has a responsibility as well. And much as you pointed out, this is obviously very contextual, because if you are an athlete, let's say you're a 100-meter sprinter, then the relative number of different inputs you have is probably going to be less than a team sport athlete, particularly as the fashion seemingly for team sport athletes is to start accumulating more and more voices, private voices as well. Professional footballers buying in individual skills coaches. I do think that in that situation, the athlete needs to be equipped to manage, listen, and be able to extract from these different inputs what they need. And I think therefore we've got a top-down and bottom-up approach rather than athlete responsible or coach responsible.
Laurie, let me just jump in. I spent Sunday afternoon watching a girls' under-12 rugby tournament, under-12s and under-14s rugby tournament in Hamilton. And found it very interesting because I spent a good chunk of it watching the coaches rather than, you know, the athletes. I mean, I was interested in the games, but particularly because we turned up quite early, so there was a lot of warming up going on. It was possible to kind of lean on the barriers and watch the coaches for a while, and it was interesting to bring it back to watching somebody 20 yards away and what their behaviours were like and what they were doing. And it was an enjoyable experience for that, just to be reminded in a sense of what the nitty gritty of that is about.
Yeah, and I love that you shared that, John, because one of the things I was thinking about before coming on this call is if you added up all, to go back to Andrew Gillett's Where Does Coaching Happen, if you added up all the time that we spent collectively as a group of six, some of us have got kids, lots of you do research, there's coaches, there's Andy who keeps saying that he gets the shit kicked out of him on a judo mat all the time, like we are doing lots of different things and it's such a huge part of our lives. So it's actually just really nice to talk about it.
And I was just going to add that I think we circle around the whole conversation, the point that Laurie's just made about the inability to just to say this is coaching and it for it to apply everywhere, which is, as John rightly pointed out, a real issue in the literature, that coaching and coaches are seen as one single entity, that we are talking about dramatically different contexts. That go beyond just the nature of the sport as well, but get into the culture and the way things are typically done, which again, I suppose for me would be a very good argument for the need for more modelling and more research for coaching rather than of coaching.
I would ask the question to all of you, just because everybody else has asked a question, that the one, I don't know whether it was Anna's or whose it was, but the second question, the bit that I found interesting in there was, what do you believe to be the invariant feature of sport coaching? Because that gave me a bit of thinking. I'd just be interested in what others, before I decide to say anything, I'd be interested in what others thought. That it's almost like the sine qua non. What does it have to be coaching? But I'd be interested in what others thought of that.
Yeah, well, I guess what you're talking to there is the question that I put in the briefing at the start, which is, you know, and it's evident in the very rich conversation that we've just had, that there are several different perspectives on what sport coaching is and perhaps what it's not. So yeah, I guess the question then to yourself, to Jamie and to Andy, and you might want to start us off, John, is what do you believe, what are the invariant features of sport coaching across these differing perspectives?
Well, I'll try. I found this very difficult to answer. I hope everybody else would find it difficult too. I did actually make a few notes. I was jotting things down. I have to start by saying I don't believe, as I said earlier, that it's a helpful concept. I don't think you can say this is what I think, well, I don't think you can say this is what coaching is, because coaching can be anything at all. Coaching can be in education, drama, art. Anybody could coach somebody else if it's only to do with assisting them, facilitating, supporting them in some generic fashion. So that doesn't take you very far. So if we mean sport coaching, then I don't think it's helpful. I think it's an umbrella term. And by that, I mean, you can't, I find it hard to provide a deep sense of meaning for sport coaching unless you also ask me, what do I mean by performance? What do I mean by a domain? What by, do I mean by context? What do I mean? What do I mean? What do I mean? So I end up with these sub concepts that all by themselves are quite controversial. You know, what do we mean by performance? Well, that will take Jamie and Andy, you know, hours to tell us exactly what they mean by performance. So I really struggled with that. I almost came down in the end to saying the only invariant was context. That my claim of you can only understand it in its particularity was the only bit that was constant. The context, the particular confluence of factors, layers, influences, people that bring you to a particular point at a particular time in a particular cycle, that particularity, I keep stressing that word, that seems to me the only bit that's an invariant. That's the bit that's there all the time. I jotted down other things like leadership, intervention, performance enhancement, competition preparation, a social relationship, a personal relationship. All of those things apply, but I'm not sure that they all invariantly apply. You know, is competition preparation always involved in sport coaching? Well, not really if you're dealing with participation coaches in a learning how to play the game context. That's learning how to play the game. It's not preparing for competition. Is it always a leadership? Yeah, well, you could probably say it's always a leadership role, but then you'd have to say what you meant by leadership. Does it always have an intervention program? Well, yeah, I'd kind of say that yes, because if there was no intervention program, well, what would coaching mean? If you weren't actually intervening in some way, putting a program, an instrumental program, a purposeful program together designed to make people's performance better. And that performance doesn't mean high level performance, it just means the doing of sport. And it can be learning to do as well as the nuance of high performance, you know, Olympic sport. So I kind of think the intervention bit is invariant, the leadership bit is invariant, and the social relationship bit is in, it's always a social activity. So, and if it's always a social activity, it's always got an interpersonal relationship bit to it. So I do think those are invariant, if that's, I'm not sure that's a great word, I'm not sure I've used that, but anyway, I think those are invariant. I did wonder about the notion of competition, and I played around with that. Competition itself is a concept. Is competition always involved in coaching? Well, you kind of say, well, competition is always involved in sport, if you define sport in a particular way. So if you do that, then you can't escape the fact that the coach has to be engaged with the notion of competition. So I found that a really challenging question. I went round the houses thinking about it. That's as far as I got, which wasn't very far. But, you know, for others to clarify where my thinking got to.
I think your road is longer than most, John, so thanks for giving it the thought.
Thank you.
Or his house is bigger, so the road around it is longer.
Well, you can see from the map. I mean, that's why it's It just means the previous occupants can pick better wallpaper.
Yeah, well, look, I can't disagree with any of that. I suppose if you look at across perspectives, you're probably talking about thinking people engaging in purposeful performance enhancement, participant development. And look, I think that clearly it's a social activity. And I think that's about as far as. So in essence, what I'm saying is I'm in agreement with John. I think, however, this is where I think it gets interesting. There's a different layer, which is there are clearly, I think it's easy to conflate what is and what isn't coaching with what are the epistemological roots that we investigate coaching. And I think that, in my opinion, far too much has been made of the differences there. And I think that we are, there is more to be gained again. And I suppose I'm banging the drum over and over again saying, lots of avenues lead us to investigate or describe coaching, and there's not a lot of avenues for us to generate research for coaching. And I think if we look at what is the same across positions, I think it's those things. But I don't necessarily, what I'm saying is, I wonder if it's even the right question to be asking. The right question to ask for me is, what's the other end of this, and what are the features that help us enhance coaching practice rather than just describe it?
Well, I would put, just Jamie, just elaborate just a tiny wee bit more, because what you could do there is to say, if you agreed with some of the bit, you know, like there's an intervention program, there's some element of leadership, I think there's a debate to be had as to whether coaches are always trying to engage in personal development of the athlete, I mean, rather than their own. I think generally speaking, yes. But we have to sometimes be clear of the difference between a prescription and the essence of something. So if you say, should we always be engaging with the development of individuals? The answer is kind of clearly yes. I mean, should we always have ethical coaching? Well, yes. Do we always have ethical coaching? Well, no. So we sometimes have to be careful with the shoulds and the do-wees. So I think from when you say we have to think about what can we do about it, I think if you identify those invariants of Derek's invariants, I think you then have some obligation to deal with them. So if you only engage with the intervention program, but you don't deal with the interpersonal stuff and you don't deal with development, then you're not doing the whole job. So once you've found, let's say, half a dozen elements of coaching that you think are invariant, you're kind of obligated to deal with all of them. Otherwise, you're doing a partial job. And we quite often do a partial job. We quite often miss out some of those bits.
I completely agree. And I suppose if we go back to the idea of conceptual clarity, personal development clearly could mean a whole lot of different things to different people.
Yeah.
But skirting over that, I agree. But leaning on that idea that Laurie offered about context, we're also missing out on the 100 and other 26 different things that the context demands of us, in addition to those 12, in my view. And we may well be talking past each other here a little bit, but my so in essence, I agree with the points that you made when in identifying different invariant elements. I then am suggesting that looking at how sports coaching has been conceptualized, I'd suggest that the different views by which, or the different lenses that researchers have taken on what coaching is, have ended up leading us to separate out and chunk out bits into different communities of practice, if you like. I don't think that's been all that helpful. And I think it has led to more and more research that is of coaching and not for coaching.
I'm trying to arrive at a point where I can tell you where that question came from. And if I consider one oversimplification in sport coaching, and let's go a little bit less highbrow just for this one. And one of the models of sport coaching that's perpetuated quite a lot within the system, and it's widely accepted, is plan, do, review. Okay, and we think about that for a second. Okay, and 2/3 of that model 2/3 of that model or that concept or that framework of how we might consider sport coaching are mental activities, planning and reviewing. But to what extent do we look to understand the mental activities of coaches and express those in the context of research, or even look to develop those things in practice? We focus a lot on the do, don't we? So we focus on the coaching behaviours, bring it back into one thing you talked about, John, in terms of, and Jamie spoke to well as well, in terms of performance development. Well, there are different methods through which we might consider how we develop performance in athletes or develop skills. Some people may take an ecological approach to how they do it. Other people may take different methods. So, like, well, we're still talking about these concepts of and invariant features of sport coaching. There are a variety of different ways in which they might be interpreted, constructed, enacted, and practiced with. So I suppose I'm making this sound a lot more complex than it is when I'm trying to bring it down and simplify it a wee bit. But I hope you can kind of get that, what I mean in terms of what I'm saying. Look, if an alien arrived on planet Earth tomorrow and asked, what's this sport coaching malarkey about? And we had three sentences to respond to him in terms of what it is, based on some common features across different perspectives, what would those three sentences consist of?
If you don't mind me jumping in on that one, given that you've lowered the level of the brow and you've asked for simplified answers, I can jump in and step in now. I don't know if I interpreted your question in the right way, Derek. And I again, with John, really struggled with the idea of an invariant feature. So I considered the area that I spent my most time in, which is from pathway to elite coaching, and looked at what are the common features that you might observe with sport coaching towards performance. When I was considering it, when I've seen it done well, and the common features I would see is a coach worked with or for an athlete to establish a vision of where they would get to. So it's helping the athlete to see what they're capable of achieving, and then using their skills, resources, behaviors, understanding and pedagogy to help them move towards said objective or said goal and vision. And within an ethical boundaries, to just add that from what John said, but also to help them to learn and establish what the positive intended and unintended consequences are of striving to achieve an objective and negating the negative consequences as and when possible. So those are the common features. If you look across sports, coaches are setting goals with athletes, as you say, plan, do, review, working within their sort of resources, skills, behaviors, knowledges to intervene and support those athletes and develop the capabilities in order to achieve those goals. And managing the 126 different inputs that Jamie mentioned to help that athlete navigate that journey towards that. So I don't know if that's an invariant feature, but it's certainly my experience of what I've seen that's common across coaches that I've worked with.
I found that helpful. And I had missed out that notion. I didn't miss it out, but that notion of setting boundaries. Sometimes it's just called goal setting, but it's broader than that. It's like setting boundaries of the nature of the relationship, as well as the nature of the ambitions and the nature of the intervention that you're engaging in. You kind of agree what that's all about. So that kind of setting boundaries, hopefully mutually, is really important. I that's useful.
I'm just looking at time, but we might have to skip question three, which was actually one that Andy and I discussed, which talked about how your experience of being coached influenced your beliefs about what sport coaching is. And it's a little bit sad we didn't get to explore that, because that could have been a cool discussion. But so we might have to move on to the quick fire. But I'm going to jump in Jamie's ever pragmatic chair. maybe that was unhelpful. but based on what you just said, what are the implications then on the work that we do as coach developers? So understanding goals of athletes, of the coach and the system that they're embedded in, and interrogating those to ensure that, and I have to think about this on a daily basis, like, you know, we spend time together, we establish direction, we consider the work that we might do together, and is that really going to support what it is that you're trying to do? And what you want and need, and what the athletes want and need, and what the system wants and needs that you're a part of. And that's often one of the most difficult sticking points that I find myself in.
Can I just, I thought you added another word in there, Andy, which we hadn't talked about, and I think is a minefield, is expertise. You know, when you talked about bringing the things that mark you and your etc. to, that's another one of these sub-concepts that's inside sport coaching that would take us another full discussion to actually say, well, what does expertise mean to a sport coach or in a sport coaching context? I don't have an answer. I'm just saying it was a really good.
No, well, I was about to say I'm not disappointed about missing out on the experience of being coach in a room full of international athletes. So you feel free to skip that.
In which case,
can I just say I don't want to answer the question necessarily either. I'm happy to move on. I think it's a really important question. I've tried to raise this a couple of times in conferences, but also in writing, and even in when I did a professorial lecture, I was trying to explain how I got to where I am, sort of, you know, that kind of picture. And one of the things was to look back and say, what was your sport experience like? So why do you think sport is like this? And I say, well, that's the only one I know. That's where I came from. So I do actually think that if not, the time is not now. There is a really important question there. You know, it's a it brings a lens that you're comfortable with. And it is worth debate in the future.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add to that, John, is that the reason I wanted to share that, or I wanted that to be a question, is we're all shaped by our experiences. My view of coaching is shaped by the coaches I've either worked with or been coached by in my journey as an athlete and as a coach. So therefore, I think that shapes how I see coaching, and therefore it would have been a useful question for everyone, but I get we don't have time.
Can I ask how that view has changed since you started working with the national agency, Andy?
And the honest answer is it hasn't. I still feel pretty passionate about the responsibility and the power a coach has to shape an athlete's life for the positive. I guess the only thing that I would say is different is I've been privy to and hear the narrative of the opposite to that. And therefore feel like coaching and coaches need to be protected. But also work within ethical boundaries. But my experience is that coaching has been an overly positive thing for me and for the people that I've worked with, and therefore would always advocate for it.
I think I'm okay with a couple of minutes. I'm sure we'll cut a lot of this, or you'll cut a lot of this. If I was just to name three, four people that I didn't work with, they worked, I think they would say they worked me. That some of you will know the name John Sayer. Sporting body mind stuff, you know, worked with Tottenham Hotspur, and I can't remember the guy's name that he worked with, who was his colleague, but he was my volleyball coach for a long time. My athletics coach was John Anderson, an aggressive Scotsman and gladiators referee, and I was a professional footballer for a lot of years, and I can give you a catalogue of absolutely useless coaches and managers, none of whom, I have to be honest and say, none of whom I had a great deal of time for. But I learned an awful lot about how not to do things, you know, including the what do you call it, the teapot throwing and the, you know, sitting around adults of 20 to 35 sitting in a circle in the dressing room while this manager tells you off and you're trying to get into the shower. But I was a PE teacher as well for 3 years at least. And I had another coach, a guy called Nick Moody, a volleyball coach, who really did emphasize for me that technique was important, that you had to get technique right in for movement purposes, and, you know, underlying movement had to be right. So I think you can actually, you know, you can kind of chart something round. And then if you say, well, your sport was volleyball, I think match coaching is really important. It's missed out of most coach education programs, how to actually manage a competition. And if you're a volleyball, basketball, ice hockey, American football, you're managing the competition. And we don't do enough of that in education and development. But because my sport was volleyball, I tend to think match coaching is really important. So I've got that lens for me is, you know, the coach is a directive person, because that's the way that's how I've always experienced it. And I've always, the other thing I thought was interesting, Andy maybe had the same, I wonder how many coaches have always been successful at sport. Until I started playing over 40s football, and which we were occasionally useless, you know, my sport experience was of being quite successful. I never experienced, if you like, bad sport. And I wonder how many coaches have come through a route that was a successful route in sport and gave them a view that this is what coaching can be, this is what sport can be like. And you maybe actually, it taints your expectations. It makes you think that everybody should be able to do it. you know, so you begin to have over expectations of things. So that, I just wanted to put that in because rather than ignore it, I really think we ought to explore that at greater length. I don't mean us now. I just think that our world of coaching should be exploring our personal, what do we call it, biographies much more, because I think it really does shape our lens that we look at sport through. Maybe we should be interviewing each other and writing about it.
That would be an interesting experiment. Anna, do you want to answer the question just because I was your coach and Jamie's egging you on?
I've had plenty of other coaches as well.
Fantastic. Right response.
Yeah, I mean, my sporting experiences weren't wholly successful despite playing Premiership and international sport. Haven't actually had lots of successful experiences to draw upon. So yeah, I mean, I played for Scotland. We lost a lot, didn't we? I can't remember many wins. but yeah, I mean, my sort of experiences growing up informed my sort of thoughts on sport. And yeah, I grew up playing football and had a pretty bad coach that probably inspired my interest in coaching and just trying to be better and be a bit more positive. I remember at age 14 being told that I wasn't the player I used to be in front of my team, fellow 14-year-old girls. So yeah, that I talk about that in my PhD thesis kind of intro. But yeah, Jamie was, I think he was asking about research. So John kind of named the biography kind of bit to it, which my research kind of links that to coaches learning. So yeah, I just really buy into this idea of how coaches' biography is very important to think about. So it's worthwhile just for everyone to consider your background and your experiences and how that shapes, well, not only your learning, but how you understand what coaching is and could that be different.
You should definitely do a separate podcast that's things you've heard whilst working with coaches that shouldn't be repeated.
But repeat it on a podcast.
But repeat it.
That coach also said, oh, if you don't want to be here, there's a door. And we were all like, we're in a field. I don't see any door that you can walk out of.
Let's let Andy run the quickfire round. You're going to answer first, though. So
that's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah, questions were co-created with our guests. So stemming from Andy's love of food. You're going to run this? I don't think John's prepared, by the way. He's got a look of panic on his face.
For what?
It's going to be the hardest question of the episode, so prepare yourself.
Is this the one about the biscuit?
Are you saying that I've got a bit of a problem with food, Laurie? Is that what you're getting at? I said it tongue-in-cheek when you said, what question would you like to ask? And I said, well, what's your favourite biscuit and why? And you seem to have included it in the question set.
Yeah, but we've worked together long enough now. It's only been a handful of weeks, hasn't it? You should know me well enough to know that, of course, that was going in the question set. So come on.
So do you want me to answer
it? Yeah, you ask it. You ask it and you answer it.
Oh, God. Well, my favourite biscuit is a custard cream. The classic custard cream. And the reason for that is they're bloody cheap. You can get like a double roll packet of custard creams for about 34p.
And out Morrison's, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, exactly. And I would quite easily destroy a whole double roll packet of biscuits with one cup of tea and maybe go fill up the cup of tea so I could finish those biscuits just because I love food and they're great. So yeah, that's my favorite biscuit and why. Same to you, John.
If I had to fall off the fence, probably in Morrison's again, with cheap biscuits, it would be a chocolate hobnob, or even a chocolate digestive. And they're only 60 pence for a packet. And with a cup of tea, you can go through quite a lot of them. I've suddenly taken to these chocolate digestives because they're so cheap.
There's a theme here, John. The two Scots have gone for the cheapest biscuits, and Jamie's going to come in with Viscounts.
Of all the many surreal moments in my life, this would be up there, I think. This is some real quality listening. I'm going to go for a cookie, bulk standard cookie. Thank you very much. And unfortunately, I don't know how much they are at Morrison's.
Are those biscuits? Is there any VAT on them?
We need to conceptualise the cookie, I think.
Do you mean like a Maryland?
No, one of those posh ones that you get at the end.
A bakery cookie.
Yeah, that's the one.
Mm. I like them too. Not so good for dunking, though.
How is it you conceptualise a biscuit? A biscuit goes soft as it goes off, and a cake goes hard.
Yeah.
That's how you...
Before Jamie falls off, Jamie's just fallen off his chair. That whole story was about Jaffa cakes, remember? Because Jaffa cakes couldn't decide whether they were a biscuit or a cake. And it made a difference to whether you charged VAT or something like that on them.
Laurie, what was your favourite biscuit? Or who would you... Yeah, what was your favourite biscuit? Come on then.
I'm savoury. Yeah, I'm not mad. I know Andy's shaking his head. No, okay. If I were to commit, I'm going to go for ones that are made for me by a pal who spent loads of time in South Africa, and they're buttermilk rusks, and they don't cost anything because she makes them for me.
A craft biscuit.
Craft biscuit. Anna and Derek, you're going to have to answer.
I'm for the chocolate hobnobs as well, actually. I do really like the cookies, but I don't conceptualise that as a biscuit.
And I would go just for a plain hobnob, and reasons being, like me, they're quite rustic and they came out in the 80s.
This part of the podcast went better than I expected.
Well, it's better than the icebreaker that you chose one day for a meeting, which is, if you were a type of weather today, what type of weather would you be?
I've never said that. That's not me.
That's bullshit, Andy, and you know it is. And I said Scotch mist. And everyone's like, what Scotch mist? Anyway, is this the point where we wrap up? Because we've just lost the plot. I guess it just leaves us to thank John and Jamie and Andy for your contributions. I think I'm going to be chewing over this podcast for a while just to try and make sense of what you guys have offered us. Quite an enjoyable episode for me, and I'm guessing I'll probably echo Laurie and Anna on that as well. So fingers crossed in the next few weeks we'll get together for a two beer minimum and try and make sense of it over a couple of craft beers. But thanks again, guys, for your participation tonight, and we'll see you all again soon.